you please join me in reading the words for lighting the chalice printed in our order of service. In the light of truth, in the warmth of love, we gather to seek, to find, and to share. Good morning. Welcome to the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. I am Susan Thompson, your lay leader today. We are an intentionally inclusive congregation, and we welcome everyone to our church. As always, we invite everyone to enjoy refreshments and conversation in House and Hall after the service. Please join with me in affirming our mission statement printed in our order of service and on our wall. We gather in community to nourish souls, transform lives, and do justice.
Do Unitarian Universalists have a faith? That could be a difficult question to answer. Indeed, how can one distinguish a Unitarian Universalist from other faith groups? That too could be a challenge. But one of the ways in which that can be done is by using the ever-faithful light bulb test. You see, in this test, you simply go to a group of people, you ask them to change a light bulb and see what happens. And if you know the right answers, you will know what faith group they belong to. All you'd have to do for your future reference is to ask any group of people how many of you is required to light and replace a light bulb and wait. Now the following, which I give to you for your future use, the following are infallible guidelines that will help you determine the members of any faith group. So if you ask a group of Anglicans, it always requires 7. 1 to call the electrician and 7 to make the martinis. For charismatics, it's no one extra is needed because everybody's hand is already in the air. For Lutherans, it's always only 1, but it's always the minister because they believe only the minister should change. For Pentecostals, it's always 1 to change the bulb and 9 to pray against the spirit of darkness. For Roman Catholics, it's done required. They only use candles. But for Unitarian Universalists, there is a special message that invariably shows up. Because the Unitarian Universalists don't change the light bulb. They make a statement about the light bulb. And the statement usually goes something like this. We choose not to make a statement either in favor of or against the need for a light bulb. However, if in your own journey you have found that light bulbs work for you, that is beautiful. You are then invited to write a poem or compose a modern dance about your personal relationship with your light bulb. Then you can present it next month at our annual Light Bulb Sunday service, in which we will explore a wide range of light bulb traditions, including incandescent, fluorescent, three-way, long life, and tinted, all of which are equally valid paths to luminescence. But is there a Unitarian Universalist faith? Let me share my answer. And my answer is stimulated, really, by a young man asking me this question several weeks ago, who after a service said, "Hey, I'm new here, and this is my first time here, and I heard you mention the word faith several times. I didn't know Unitarian Universalists had a faith. So I'm here to say, yes, we do have a faith. But it is faith, I believe, in its most basic and original word, meaning of trust. Because if you actually go back into the New Testament tradition, the word faith really meant trust. So it wasn't belief in something very difficult to believe, but it was rather a call to a more trusting network of relationships. So when I say faith, I am really meaning a fundamental and basic trust. And a trust, as such, always involves risk. I've had a lot of time to think about this over the years. And for me, the faith of a Unitarian Universalist consists of three concentric circles. And the widest circle is the principles of our association. The affirmation of the seven principles is, for me, the price of admission into our congregations. And each of these principles, if you look at them closely, involve trust and involve risk. We can believe in the basic and intrinsic goodness and dignity of all persons, but people will not always act in accord with that. We can engage in democratic process, but that doesn't always seem to work as well as we would want. Our impatience presses us towards other things. And so it is with each principle. It calls forth the need to trust. But for me, the seven principles are the first and most basic of these circles. Our congregations are not just gathering places for nice people or a social hub or a place to do socially righteous and beneficial things. Although all of these things do occur, but our congregations are primarily and fundamentally a place of intentional aspiration to let principles guide behavior and words. Principles that come down to us from history, but were forged in the fires of our democratic movements on process of discovery and affirmation. And so when a person walks through the doors entering this space or any part of our church, it is the statement that that person is willing to enter into a covenant, indeed a concentric ring of covenants, to be a part. For this is an institution standing with and among other institutions in our society, which has, in my opinion, the fundamental mission of encouraging people to live by principles that are honored by history and tradition and by the people of our movement. It is possible for a congregation and its people to ignore the seven principles or to treat them as abstract ideas or historical reference points rather than to see them as living statements of an ongoing covenant that we have with one another. The second concentric circle inside that large first circle is the culture and values of an individual congregation. This too is very distinctive about our religious movement. And this circle is best expressed by the mission, the vision, the ends and the goals of a congregation. Some churches don't have this. Last year, I was really amazed when I worked in Canada to see the number of congregations that felt no need to develop a mission or a set of goals or ends for itself. And the religious movement of Unitarianism in Canada suffers as a result of that. So it's possible to not do that. This congregation is way ahead of the game in that for the last 2 years you have been doing that. You've created a covenant of healthy relationships. You've created a mission statement, a value statement, an end statement. All of these are wonderful and bode very well for the health and well-being of this congregation. The third in the inner circle is the fate of the individual. And by that I mean a person's struggle to develop ever deeper levels of trust in themselves, trust in people in their community, trust in the network that they are, of relationships that they are a part of. This principle, this aspect of our life together is even codified in a principle, namely a free and responsible search for truth and meaning is one of our seven principles. In other traditions, truth and meaning are given to them. Here we find it and forge it by ourselves in the context of community. This is asking much of people. It creates a burden of responsibility, but it is the way we have chosen. We are a place, and I must say that this is a barely explored territory for many UU congregations, but we are fundamentally, within these two first concentric circles, a place to help people in their search for truth and meaning and purpose. We are here. It is our endpoint to help people build up their lives, their individual lives, their personal lives, their relationships. The endpoint of our congregation, of any congregation, is not continual, unceasing rebellion, but reaching a new vision of truth and meaning absent in the conventional orthodoxies that surround us. There is much, much more to be done to help people find their path. Now, against this position that I'm describing, in which fate is a part of the three concentric circles, there stands an interesting fact about our religious movement that I cannot overemphasize. And that is that our congregations are profoundly influenced by what you could call going away energy, the energy of moving away from the orthodoxies, the religious orthodoxies that are all around us, that many of us, if not every one of us, have fled from in our effort to be more authentic as persons. And this energy is so strong, it is so powerful, that it affects many aspects of our life together. And one aspect it affects is that it obliterates this sense that we are, after all, fundamentally, a faith community called upon to help people build their trust, build their faith, build themselves, build their families, build their lives as strong as possible. It is very hard, for example, for people to hear the phrase faith development and not think immediately of conventional religious faith. We need to find a way to work through these challenges. Our individual faith positions include a lot of overlap. The seven principles, the covenant of right relations, the individual culture and values of congregations. But also, it will always contain an irreducible individual and personal element. For each human being, each of us is like everyone else in many ways, but there is a part of us that is fundamentally unique. And if each person is truly to find that which sets them free and gives them an inner certainty and gives them a true center, that will always be different from every other person. So how then can we speak about a unity amid such diversity? Over the last 3 weeks, I talked, just in this congregation, I talked to people who were irreducibly earth-centered in their spirituality. I talked to people who had a profound and deep Jewish tradition that they were living from and coming from and working through. I talked to other people who came from a version of Protestant Christianity, and they were working through that. And as they go through their spiritual journeys, they will each come to a unique resolution for what is right for them. How can we speak about unity if we're faced with so much diversity? I wish to share an experience with you that may provide a hint for the solution to this question. And it involves an experience I had while flying from Seattle to Chicago to Buffalo. Last year, I worked for about 10 days a month with a congregation in Canada. And to get the cheapest fares, I went from Seattle to Chicago to Buffalo. Now, as you know, everybody in Seattle is very mellow. But then as you get into Chicago, you pick up a little rougher element, and then you go towards Buffalo, and it gets more intense. On this particular flight, I was in the middle seat on the front row on the right side of the plane. I'd been minding my own business between Chicago and Buffalo. But during the last 10 minutes of the flight, a man sitting to my left began to talk in what I can only describe as a very mean-spirited way to the stewardess, who was sitting in a seat right next to the bathroom that's right adjacent to the cockpit. Well, as we made our final descent, as we began that, he began to talk to the stewardess in a way that was vicious. And I had a bit of a hearing difficulty at the time because I had this horrific allergy thing going on. But I was able to piece together what he was saying. And what the problem was, as he understood it, was that the stewardess, looking for a place to put his overhead luggage, had put it about 4 or 5 rows behind us. He and I were sitting on the front row. And this man was very angry with the stewardess that she had done this. And it was probably, I thought, by necessity that she had done this. Now, as the plane gets closer and closer to landing, this man seems to be furious that he is going to be forced to go back against the flow of traffic and to get his luggage. He's very angry, but almost in a quiet, cold rage kind of way. And there was something about him, and there was something about what he said, and there was something about the way he said it that sent a cold chill down my back. And I don't get cold chills down my back that often in airplanes. He tells the stewardess in this menacing way that she is going to get his luggage for him, or else, it seems. The stewardess replies that it was by necessity that she did this and that she had no intent to get his luggage. And so I begin to imagine a fight is going to break out when the plane ends, and I begin to plot my strategy. So I'm going to grab both of his arms and pull him behind his back and put my knee in his back and throw him to the floor. And then I realize I'm too old to get into fights like this. And I think of other possibilities, but still I have my resolve. The plane stops. He jumps up. He rushes back before anybody could hardly get up. But he brushes against other people rather rudely. He grabs his luggage and he flies back to the front of the plane. And he's the first one at the door to get off. Now, at the same time that this little drama is going on, there is a man on the opposite side of the plane, against the window, on the window seat, who has the exact same problem. His luggage is way back there too. And during this, he calls out to someone several rows behind him, "Sir, could you please get my luggage for me in the overhead storage?" And the man complies, and two people pass the luggage, and it all happens simply, naturally, and quickly. And the man thanks the persons who helped him. It was more than one person. And then it is over. There seemed to me to be so much of life packed into this little drama. One man believed that others were against him, that others were trying or willing to do wrong to him, that there was no one to help him, that he had to struggle against others to get what he wanted, and that the world was probably a hostile place, and that he could trust no one. The other person believed that he could find help if he was willing to ask for it, and that he could trust the world to be supportive if he would have the adventure and the risk of trust, and that he could work with others to have his needs met, and that other people might actually be interested in his well-being. The first man, the dear gentleman to my left, sent waves of anxiety and fear. The second man called forth the possibilities always there to build connections. These two ways of being summarize what we are trying to do in this place we call church. What the second person did is what all three concentric rings and circles lead to. We are engaged here as an institution in trying to create a space in which trust, compassion, hope, generosity, the assumption of positive intent guides human interaction. It is a place in which we are trying to build up the community of mutual respect. This is not easy. It is hard sometimes. Sometimes we go against the grain of our human tendencies in living with principle. Sometimes we fall back into destructive ways. Sometimes we need to call ourselves back into covenant, but we get up from the ground, stand up, and walk and move forward. Some of our most worldly wise perspectives within ourselves would tell us that this is naive. And therein lies one of many temptations to regress and to not be the beloved community we are called to be. And how we do it is, in my opinion, through these three concentric circles of the seven principles, congregational values, and individual trust and faith development. This leads us to a place where we are living like the man who asked for help, who assumed good intentions of others, who evoked the ever-present possibilities of trust, who acted respectfully towards others. It is not possible ever for us as individuals to have the very same beliefs and ideas and even goals. Our individuality is too precious. It's too valuable. It is the road to authenticity, our individualism. But we can all agree on where our free search for truth and meaning leads to, what the consequences look like. And this is the paradox. Only living by the most private and personal search do we find our truth and meaning. And that endpoint will be unlike anyone else's endpoint. And yet, when we make this journey, we find ourselves ending up the closest to one another. For this journey leads us by a thousand different paths to that one place where our lives flourish, that place where there is compassion, hope, trust, and generosity. So may it be. Amen.
Our offering words are by Judith Meyer. We all have so many needs. 1,000 prayers, 1,000 needs that really need only one answer. Let the world not be indifferent. And may we live and be with each other in the way that shows this truth, whatever the day brings, that neither are we indifferent to each other. The offering will now be given and received in grateful appreciation of our shared hopes and values.
I share with you this benediction. May the strength of our mother, the earth, and the peace of still deep waters, and a compassion embracing all persons, leaving no one out, be in us and among us and between us until we gather again in this sacred home of hope. Amen.
This is a presentation of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, visit our website at www.austinuu.org.